You're listening to Roundtable Talks on RNIB Connect Radio, and it's time to pack your bags because we're talking all about travelling. Travelling as a blind or partially sighted person can be a brilliant and challenging adventure. Accessibility standards and awareness of blind and partially sighted people vary across the globe, and language barriers can add extra challenges if you're asking for information or support. But experiencing different environments and cultures can make for magical memories, help boost your confidence, and introduce you to great new people and ideas. Today, we'll be hearing the experiences of three intrepid travellers and getting advice on globetrotting. Our first panellist is Lucy Ashton. She is 28 years old and was born with a genetic visual impairment called Best's disease. She has a lot of travelling experience personally and professionally as she works for the See Able Holidays team, a company that provides accessible, inclusive holidays to the sight loss community. Hi Lucy, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi Amelia.
Our second panellist is Jonathan Abro, who regularly shares his travel experiences with RNIB Connect Radio in his travel logs. He has retinitis pigmentosa, has been to all seven continents, and is particularly fond of good food and sloths, which he's seen many times. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Amelia.
And our final panellist is Tony Giles, a blind and deaf traveller and writer who has visited over three quarters of all of the UN-listed countries. He shares his experiences on his blog, Tony the Traveller, and has published three books all about his travels. Thanks for joining us, Tony.
Hi, Amelia. Thanks for having me.
So let's get started with you, Tony. What is one of your most magical moments from travelling?
I think for me, one of the most magical moments was stepping foot on the Antarctic continent for the first time back in 2011. It was just breathtaking from an all sensory point of view, the massive open space in front of me. And even though it was like 83 people together in a group, it was just so much space, almost just felt silent, apart from the penguins and the smell of poo.
I couldn't agree with you more. And how amazing that in 2011, I was also in Antarctica and felt exactly the same. The space, the grandness of everything, and yeah, the penguins and the poo, but just marveling at the sounds of silence was quite something. And I was privileged enough to camp on the ice one night, which was quite spectacular.
Just a sort of sense of vastness, really.
Yeah, totally. We were in a small boat, just four of us, in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and the boat driver turned off the engine, and we all just sat there in silence. It was magnificent.
That sounds incredible. I mean, my experience of that would be similarly. I went to Iceland a few years ago. That's a destination I thought, I don't know, I never imagined myself going to. But we climbed a glacier. We went in the Blue Lagoon. And it's a real sensory experience, to be honest, going somewhere like Iceland or Antarctica. I guess the temperature difference, and it was incredible. So, yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah, Blue Lagoon was gorgeous, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to experience. If people have never been there, I would highly recommend that.
Totally agree.
I like the idea in Iceland that you could be outside and your whole body was sat in sort of warm temperature and your head was like freezing. And yeah. I sort of like the contrast. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and actually the daylight, because they obviously only have... I went in December time, there's only a short amount of daylight,
right,
which was really strange on your mind to kind of adapt to. And it makes you feel really funny, actually. But it's that, you know, that adds to the experience of, you know, going to somewhere like Iceland as well. So, yeah, it's really cool.
We went across to the glacier. It's the largest glacier in Europe. And I still had a tiny bit of central vision at the time. So I was able to actually ride one of the snowmobiles across the glacier, which was awesome. Yeah, Lucy, your wow actually sums it up perfectly.
And when you both travel, do you travel with family or friends? Kind of how do you go about kind of planning these kind of, you know, incredible trips?
So I do my research on my laptop. I travel by myself. I started when I was young, when I was 18, 19, and I got to study in the States and then just went off backpacking. And then did it again in Australia and New Zealand, and I could speak the language and sort of understand how the infrastructure worked. And then I was really confident. I thought, all right, let's go to Thailand and Vietnam and just meet people on the streets, really. Find someone who can speak a bit English and say, oh, where are you going today? Just tag along with people. And now I research it more because the country is a bit more complicated. And then sometimes I'll join a group, like when I went to Ayers Rock, the easiest way there was just to join a group. And then other times I'll go off by myself.
When you travel, what are your priorities? What are the things that you look to plan first?
So I pick a country and I decide, I research the cities, towns, places I want to visit. And then I'll look at how to get from the airport to my accommodation, whether I can use public transport or I have to get a taxi, because I'm always on a budget. So I'm always aware of how much money I can spend on any transport, accommodation, food. And then after that, I find accommodation. She's like a hostel or a cheap guest house or something. And I also use something called couchsurfing.com, where you can stay with local people for free. And you just like offer them to take them for a meal or something. And that way I can really get to meet local people rather than just staying in a hotel, which is a bit generic. And then I plan the kind of things I want to visit, like churches, or I find out to look at audio guides in museums, or fountains I can hear, or statues I can touch, waterfalls I can get to, stuff like that, really.
I would say I'm quite a confident person, but obviously being a visually impaired adult woman, I guess there's some situations that can feel quite daunting. So, you know, I think, like Tony said, as much research as possible is key. Even things like, you know, arrival times of your flight always arrive in the middle of the day. So then I know, you know, you're in the daylight hours, it's going to be a safer time. There'll be more transport to use, more people around to ask questions to. But, you know, when you go somewhere further afield, such as Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, it's the language barrier is there for anybody, you know, whether you're VI or not. But that can definitely make things more difficult for you. But I guess it's all just planning, prioritising the right things, what's important for you, you know, for your holiday. Whereas I personally would prefer not a hostel. I like a nice fancy hotel because to me that feels safer. But I absolutely understand, you know, the idea of a hostel is really fun and kind of different experiences. Staying with local people, I think, is so cool. And also you have to appreciate, I guess, the culture difference in different places that you go to and the attitudes towards, you know, people with visual impairments, people with any kind of disability is a challenge as well. So I work for a company where we travel, you know, all around the world, you know, as far as Asia, all around Europe. And you really do see a difference in kind of attitudes culturally towards yourself and kind of the people that I'm with. So, yeah, people do want to travel and try these new things, but it can be really scary. The three of us obviously have traveled quite a lot, which is absolutely incredible. And I think it's so important to inspire other people to do the same.
Totally. When I started traveling, it was back in 1990. I was living in South Africa at the time, and so it was a big deal to get on an aeroplane and go somewhere. At that time, I didn't even know I was visually impaired, and it was only while I was out backpacking that I'd been away for almost 2.5 years. My parents wanted to see me because no internet, and as a backpacker, there's not really time to communicate. You're far too busy, so they heard from me occasionally. And when I was driving them through Denver, my father turned to me and said, "You just drove through a red light." And my answer was, "What light?" So, of course, that was the start of my sight loss journey. And as my vision deteriorated over the years, travel obviously changed, but didn't stop by any means. I love adventurous travel. I'm also extremely lucky. I met the most amazing partner, Annie, who also loves travel. So we go off and do all sorts of things, from jungle trekking in Borneo to we climbed Mount Kilimanjaro together and walked on the sand dunes in the Gobi Desert. So I'm really lucky about that. But when we do plan our trips, sometimes we're quite impromptu and we just go off to wherever seems like it's a good idea because the price is right or the season is right or both. One of the things that I really do suggest and did with great success recently, I wrote to the tourist board in Venice, and they came back to me with all sorts of information, and the most valuable of it was, when you get to places like the Doge's Palace, don't book in advance, go to the front of the queue, and you will be welcomed in for free with your companion. And we did just that. What a pleasure. It turns out that a lot of Italy is like that, as is London. I had the very same experience at St. Paul's. I just recently rocked up to the front door and got taken on a touch tour, which was astounding.
Wow. Wow. I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's knowing those little pieces of information really do make a difference.
Mm.
And I guess it's the confidence to do that as well.
Exactly.
can be a lot, because, you know, you've got to be quite bold to walk to the front of a queue of tourists, I guess. Yeah, like you said, in Italy, it is very much like that.
Also in France, we were, my girlfriend and I, she's also blind and Greek, and we were studying a queue to go in Notre Dame, and they saw us with our sticks and they just waved us forward. 200 people, and we just walked past them all and then they took us in.
Wow.
The first time I experienced it was actually in an airport at Sao Paulo in Brazil. And we were standing in the line and the steward at the front came across to me and said, "If you're blind, you do not stand in a queue. You just come straight to the front." And actually, I took that as being, that's what I do. Mm. And so while I'm cautious about certain places and when I do it, you're right, Lucy, it does take confidence to walk to the front of the queue.
Yeah.
But I am willing to do it, and you never really get any pushback, because I think people are more admiring and happy to see someone like any of us there with a blind cane. And so rather than giving us a hard time, they're sort of thinking, wow, they're actually here doing that.
Yeah. For me, I would describe my visual impairment as hidden. So I guess that comes with it, you know, its whole other kind of challenges, I guess. Mm. So
yeah.
I think that is where personally I struggle, because, you know, I don't look like someone who does have a visual impairment. So, you know, I have to wear my lanyard in the airports. I have to be a lot more vocal about my visual impairment and explain it in a lot more detail, really, which, you know, it does feel unfair at times.
Yeah.
You know, but I understand that, you know, it's hard for people, you know, in the UK to understand, let alone, you know, in all these different places I'm going to.
Exactly.
But it is just about knowing your rights and know what you are entitled to. And the airports, you know, in itself, I don't know what both of your experiences are in the airports or with assistance. But it's very hit and miss, I would describe it as.
Totally.
Well, because being totally blind, I always... Once I book flights, well, I get other people to book flights for me because the websites are pants and with a screen reader. So once I've got flights booked, I book assistance because I'm very confident. I've been a long cane user since I was the age of 10. I get myself to the airport and then I'll just find someone, tell them which airline company, and they'll take me to the check-in desk and I'll tell them I've got special assistance. And then it normally works like clockwork then, and I'm just whizzed through. And you jump all the queues. And also, being totally blind, a lot of people find airports got scary and noisy and chaotic. But when you don't see that, it makes it an easier, better experience, in my experience.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic to hear. I've got about 1-2% of peripheral vision remaining, nothing else. And yeah, I do get the movement and all of that, but lucky enough to have been to the airport so many times that it's more a case of, all right, where are we going for a drink or a coffee, depending on the time of the day?
I would say I'm a bit of a nerd in terms of I'm passionate about the airport assistance in terms of I have quizzed every person that's ever assisted me in terms of their training and, you know, their experiences of, you know, guiding people. Because a lot of the time the training in the airports is just kind of disabilities as a whole, they're trained. And it is one of the lower payer jobs in the airport. And I've heard that lots of people do that first before they move on to, you know, security and other things. But I don't think that is good enough, because that level of care needs to be so much better. But it is improving. You know, some people are absolutely incredible at the job. Like, I've had amazing people. But, you know, some people just haven't had the right training. You know, it's not a personal thing.
And I think also it's different cultures as well. It's just,
exactly.
You know, people in the UK are very much more exposed to interacting with disabled people of all different disabilities. And you get people, lovely, very kind, very, you know, willing to help, but not always certain the best way how to guide or how to help someone, you know, because of different Africa or Asia, and it's not what they're exposed to so much. So a lot of it's that interaction and communication.
Totally. And we kind of almost train people ourselves, which is so important because, you know, if we're not willing to share what we need, how on earth can people know what we need?
Exactly. about breaking down those barriers and the communication.
Yeah.
And just explaining in a polite way, this is what I need, this is what I don't need.
Yeah.
Totally. And if they don't do it quite right, it's okay. You know, you're only with them for that moment of your life and they're there to help you. So just enjoy the moment, ask them about their day and carry on having, you know, the time of your life. You're on holiday, hopefully. Have either of you been to the Kuala Lumpur airport and had assistance through that?
Nope, I've never.
Going out, not coming in.
Okay, that was an experience in itself because we were flying from, we'd flown in from Borneo and we were going off on a flight elsewhere and the connection time was really tight. This young man came and picked us up from the aircraft and he said, can you walk fast? I said, yes, I can. So we went at speed and he was shouting ahead to his colleagues all along the way, which way to this, that, or the other, because it's a giant airport. And he got us through. He got us onto the plane in time. We made our connection, and it was brilliant.
Wow.
I had an interesting experience in Vietnam. There's a book, The Assistant, so no problem getting on in wherever it was. Landing in Vietnam in Ho Chi Minh City, assistants met me. Not much English, fine. It took me to the security and walked off.
No.
I was left there by myself thinking, right, how do I get my luggage and how do I get through here? And luckily, an Australian Vietnamese lady came through behind me and said, I'll help you. So that was an interesting moment. Yeah.
How do you cope in moments like that when some people would feel panicked in a different place, not knowing what to do?
I guess you've just got to kind of put a level head on and just kind of think, okay, I'm in this situation now, there isn't anyone here to help me, I need to resolve this myself. So I think, like we keep saying, it is the communication, it's talking to, I guess, anyone around you who is willing to help you in that moment. And, you know, it is a matter of doing your research before you get there. You know, it's very stressful for anybody, whether you're VI or not, being in the airport. I think you just have to make sure you've got your phone on you, you've got internet, you know, you can contact people or emergency numbers of the airline, airport, those kind of things are the best ways. But personally, because I do have some sight, I can kind of navigate that way. Jonathan and Tony, what do you kind of do in those moments?
I always say never underestimate the kindness of strangers.
That's right.
Because people love to help. And so given an opportunity, and with somebody explaining how they need help, they'll go out of their way. I mean, we've had it so many places, not just in airports. I've been in Japan lost and asked somebody who took out their phone and not just checked the map, but walked me all the way there. And so, honestly, you know, something that I live by is if someone offers me help, I never turn it down. And the reason for that is if you... And this is an experience that actually happened to me. I was in Bank Tube Station, getting off a train, knowing exactly where I needed to go. And somebody said to me, would you like some help? And I said, no thanks, I'm fine. And I felt this deflation. And I thought, I'm never going to make that happen again. So now if someone offers me help and I'm in that same situation where I know exactly where I need to go, I say, yes, please. Would you take me to, and I pick a landmark, stairs or whatever, and we walk along, have a bit of a chat, and they either are going the same way as me, so we continue the chat, or they leave with a bounce in their step. So no matter where you are, whether it's here in your home or abroad at some airport or train station where hardly anyone speaks your language, ask for help. It's not a sign of lack of independence. It's a sign of strength.
Exactly.
Yeah, and half the time, you know, you have a conversation with someone and... But by the time they've taken you to where you want to go, you've almost made a friend with someone. And says, oh, you exchange phone numbers and sometimes you meet up later. And
yeah, exactly. And a lot of the time, it's not just the VI people that might be knowing, you know, if you're in the right place or anything like that. Airports are daunting places for everybody. So there's always everyone asking everyone for help in one way or another. So it's not, like you said, it's not a weakness, you know. It's everyone's doing the same thing, whether you're VI or not. I think, yeah. You know.
And having a white cane is such an advantage.
Yes.
If you just stand there in the middle of chaos in an unknown airport or an unknown station, people just navigate to you.
Yeah.
They just say, do you need help? Where are you going? And then...
Even when you've got somebody with you, people will still come up to you and say, can I help you? And isn't that marvellous?
Are there any big challenges that you've come across while travelling?
I'd say the biggest challenge is getting visas as a blind person, whether it's going to an embassy in London or getting visas whilst travelling. Because when I travel, I'll plan a trip and I'll try and visit 3 or 4 countries in a 2-month trip. Getting a visa stamp on a border, and it happened a couple of times to me in Africa or in South America. So I've got my exit stamp, and then more or less at the same place you get your entry stamp. And with not seeing, I've not always known that I've got the entry stamp, and I've turned up at accommodation and I've asked to see my passport. So you've got no entry stamp. I'm like, ah. And being blind, getting a visa, you have to sort of provide a lot of proof that you've got some connection, someone to stay with, or you've got an itinerary and they want to know all these details. And they're just looking for how can you possibly cope on your own in a foreign country? So you have to do a lot of explaining.
Yeah, I think because my visual impairment is hidden, it is the cultural differences, the different places I go to, and kind of having to explain that. Mm. And even after explaining it, it not being understood. I actually volunteered in Ghana in Africa for 2 months, and that was a whole project all about changing the stigma attached to blind people in Ghana. A lot of the time people think I was just there as a sighted guide, but I was actually there as, you know, a visually impaired participant. Mm. You know, that was a real kind of culture shock that there is such a big stigma attached to blind people in the place where I was. But, you know, it was incredible what we did. We taught people to play goal ball. People who are blind in the community were then kind of glorified at the end of this 2 months because they were so incredible at this sport that we taught them. That the sighted people who couldn't play very well. But, you know, but it was absolutely one of the biggest challenges of my entire life, if I'm perfectly honest. But I think that challenge would be a challenge for anyone, whether you're sighted or not. But, you know, my confidence has grown since working for Seeable Holidays, actually. You know, I'm the person that takes the stress away from all of the customers. I'm the one that does the planning of activities. Yeah, so I really am super passionate about it. And I want, you know, everyone should have the right to travel. Totally. Because, you know, it's so important, you know, for everybody.
You know, we've spoken about planning, and we all plan. Even the best laid plans and all of that. So things do go wrong, and it's managing when those things go wrong. And one of the hardest times of my life was we were on a trek through Tiger Leaping Gorge in China, and you're walking along an edge which, if you step to the right, you're not there anymore. And we had planned a route. We started early enough in the morning. We stopped for lunch where we were supposed to, and we didn't get to our accommodation at the time we thought we would, because we actually hadn't been told how far it was. You know, it's just around the corner. And so as we were walking along, it got sort of towards dusk, which by then I can't see a thing. Then it started raining. Then it got really dark, and then it started pouring with rain. So I was walking along. I was holding my guide's hand in front of me and Annie's hand behind me, and just stepping 1 foot in front of the other. What they didn't tell me until after we'd got to the accommodation was there was one part where I'd heard some gushing water, but Annie had motioned to the guide not to say anything to me because they'd walked me over a log across a raging torrent of water. And although I could feel the difference in the terrain, I was just concentrating on putting 1 foot in front of the other all the way. And I have to say that to me was without doubt my biggest challenge in life, because it was understanding what it felt like to be truly blind in that moment. Mm. And although I had this tiny bit of peripheral vision, I couldn't see a thing. So I think the thing about challenges is take one step at a time, and there's always a way out of them. You might need help, you might need to hold someone's hand, but it's just about moving forward until you get to where it is you need to be.
Do you feel like you've learned to trust your instincts more as a traveller, or do you just learn how to roll with the punches a bit more?
I think since kind of travelling and going to different places, you do realise you are capable of so much more than you even think It is amazing how the brain can navigate and learn a route. You know, I've developed a skill where I can do one route now somewhere brand new, and I know the route instantly then if I have to do that again. You know, that's an amazing skill to have, and I wouldn't even know I had that skill unless I travelled to all these places and new experiences. People underestimate visually impaired and blind people, definitely. If you want to travel the world, you absolutely can. And there is so many, you know, if you want to do it on your own, you absolutely can, if you've got that confidence and kind of knowledge and research. But like the company I work for, See Able Holidays, you know, there are companies out there that can absolutely help you do that as well.
Yeah, there's so many different ways to travel. And I think the more I travel, when I was young, I was traveling for escapism and partying and not really understanding how to be as a blind and deaf person. And as I've traveled more and gone to more unusual places, I've just become so much more relaxed about traveling, much more open to the people I've met and the cultures, and more relaxed about myself. And having accepted my blindness and deafness, it made life so much easier.
Yeah, and there is always an element of trust. You do have to ask for help along the way, as I've said. And like Tony, I stay in hostels sometimes. And like you, Lucy, I do enjoy the occasional treat of a fancier hotel. But wherever you're staying, I mean, you know, if you're staying in a hostel and there's a shared bathroom, you've got to make sure you know your way there and back in the dark, because people want to sleep. You can't start turning on the lights. And yeah, and you just have to learn. There's lots of skills we have. We just have to learn to use them.
For me, I've always had to trust people because I've been blind in my life. I've had to trust people, you know, give me good directions, help me cross the road. I've always had to trust people. I had to trust people, you know, help me use a cash machine in a country where there's no audio machine, and judging who can I trust that person with this information, and can I trust them with that? And, you know, so you try and work that as you go, really, with experience. And sometimes you get it wrong. Sometimes things happen, but yeah, it's all part of it.
It is.
Yeah, and I think I would advise people thinking about traveling and kind of what experiences they could have. I would start off small, I think. There's amazing places to visit in the UK. See how you are. See how you do navigate on your own, or asking for help and that kind of thing. And then go a bit further. You know, you can go, like we said, you can go on trains all around Europe if you want to. Then you can go even further to Asia. I would advise this to sighted people as well. Start off small, and then, you know, then the world is literally your oyster. So,
you know, go with a friend, or, you know, go with someone you like to start with, and find out if you do like going away, if you do like travelling, you know, find out if it's for you or not. Because it should be fun. It shouldn't be daunting and scary all the time. It should be fun.
Totally. And you know, not everybody wants to travel in the way that we clearly do, which is solo travel. That's why there are companies like yours, Lucy, so that people can be helped every step of the way. And sighted or not, there are many, many people who wouldn't travel if it weren't for that being available.
Yeah, I travel with my girlfriend, who's not quite as adventurous as me, because she lost her sight when she was 16, so she's not had the skills that I've been fortunate to be given. But when we travel together, we travel a bit slowly and do things, you know, a bit differently, but we still have fun and get something out of it, which is what matters at the end of the day.
Do you have any tips for travelling with other people?
I would say make sure you know the people you're traveling with, you know, make sure you pick the right friend. But no, I think, you know, everything in the world is always about communication. I think if, you know, because I'm going to Vietnam and Cambodia, and that is with a group of 10 participants, 5 staff members. So all these people have never met each other before. I always say to people, you know, everyone is in the same mindset in terms of, you know, they've all agreed to go on this kind of adventurous, incredible, once in a lifetime holiday. So you're already all in that same mindset. You're going to have days where you're tired. You're going to have days where you're not feeling it. You might not like every single activity, but that's okay. Just you can say it. I think just communication with the people you're with is so important.
And setting the boundaries, setting it right.
Yes.
You know, my girlfriend didn't want to go to a museum because it's all about military history. So she chilled in the hotel, and I went off for a couple of hours, and I did what I wanted to do and came back, and then we went and had lunch together. So it's about that communication and making sure you've got those clear boundaries. And the same with money, you know, we'll try and make it equal. So I'll buy lunch, so she'll buy dinner. And that way we try and keep it as equal as possible.
Yeah, and I think it's also about compromise, because if you are going off on an adventure and you've both, or all of you in the group, have done your research, if it's not a planned, organized trip, not everybody wants to visit all the places, but, you know, that's part of it. And go, because you never know. You might come across something that you thought, well, I don't want to go there, but turns out it's an amazing place to visit. And things change along the way depending on the type of travel you do. You might be in a hostel and someone will say, you really have to go and see X, Y, and Z. So you change your route, and that's also the beauty of travel and changing.
What's the most helpful lesson you've learned on your travels? And we'll come to you first, Jonathan.
The most helpful thing I've learned on my travels goes back to my story of accepting the help of strangers. I think for me, understanding that it's not a failure to ask people was such a powerful thing that I learned when I started doing it when I couldn't see anymore. Because no matter where in the world I've been, I've always been in situations where I've needed help and I haven't had anyone with me, and people around me have always been there to help. So I think that, for me, is one of the most valuable things.
How about you, Tony?
To be yourself. For a long time, I sort of travelled when I was younger. I tried to fit in with other people, tried to fit in with the groups, and, you know, being sort of life soul and party. And one day I sort of realised I was with some local people, and they just accepted me who I was. They weren't fussed that I was blind. Just be yourself.
How about you, Lucy?
I think kind of the biggest lesson I've ever learned is to truly believe in yourself. When I was in school, I was denied a place on a volunteering experience in Africa. Due to my visual impairment, I was told only 24-hour supervision, which was absolutely incorrect. But I just used that as motivation. And, you know, I've been to Africa for 2 months, lived there, volunteered, changed the stigma attached to blind people. And now every day as a job, I create holidays and take people who are visually impaired and blind away on holidays. So I think it's just, you know, believe in yourself. You're capable of so much more than your brain even thinks. And you've got to challenge yourself and try different things. And it's okay if it goes wrong. It's okay if you have to ask for help. I think just believe in yourself. You can, if you wanna go and travel somewhere, you absolutely can. I think, yeah, so just believe in yourself.
Well, thank you so much, Lucy Ashton, Tony Giles and Jonathan Abrow, for joining us for our Travel Roundtable on RNIB Connect Radio.